You can find this podcast and others at Gun Rights Radio Network, gunrightsradio.com. Podcasting freedom.
The Liberals Gun Corner, a proud member of the Gun Rights Radio Network, hosted by Cowboy T, San Francisco liberal with a gun. This podcast is always available at www.liberalsguncorner.com, and you can email us at cowboyt@liberalsguncorner.com. Cowboy T here. This marks our 21st episode. Welcome. I know we've been pretty heavy duty the last several episodes. Well, there's a reason. It's because there's been a lot of pretty heavy duty stuff to talk about. It's been almost, oh gosh, a year since we started the Liberals Gun Corner. And we figured, well, time to see what people are saying, if anything at all. Turns out, yeah, some people are saying some things. They are listening to the show, and that's good. A lot of the feedback's positive. Some of it's critical. That's good, too. This is America. We're supposed to be doing that here. If everyone else agreed with me, well, I'm pretty sure the world would be a pretty boring place. So we're going to go through some of our letters here. Oh, by the way, if you do write in, there is a chance that I will select it for reading on the air like I'm about to do now. If you prefer to remain anonymous, I will honor that. Just tell me. If you prefer only, say, first name and city or state or whatever, that's fine too. I will respect all of that. Most importantly, understand this. You don't have to agree with me. Though, yeah, a lot of people seem to. That's not required to get on the Liberals' Gun Corner. I ask only this. That you make a cogent, rational case. No name-calling. Be respectful and polite. Keep the potty-mouth type stuff to, well, the potty, where it belongs. You know, the standard golden rule type stuff. You can email us here at cowboyt@liberalsguncorner.com. Okay, let's get to it. One of our listeners, Keith from Alabama, says the following. Just wanted to thank you. I've since purchased a classic turret and a Dillon 650 XL, rather, with case feeder. Looking next to obtain a Pro 1000 to dedicate to 9mm. I'm casting 41 mag, 44 mag, 480 Ruger, and 1-ounce Lee slug. I shoot to reload, I guess. I'm a lawyer who owns and operates a hardware store, and I'm as conservative Republican as they get, but I do care about my fellow citizens. I just want a smaller government, lower taxes, and freedom for everyone to pursue happiness as long as it doesn't hurt or cost me or anyone else. For example, gay marriage doesn't hurt me, so I don't care if it's legalized, even if I'm straight as an arrow. Your podcast is persuasive without appearing inflexible or closed-minded, and to that, I tell you to keep it up. Very entertaining and informative. You never know, I might become a Gomer Powell-voiced Southern redneck Methodist liberal. By the way, do reloading YouTube on 762x54R as I'm tired of the corrosive stuff. Your fan, Keith. Keith, thank you. And you know what? You're not the only one who's asked me to do a reloading video on rifle cartridges. I don't get nearly as much of a chance to shoot that Mosin as I'd like to, unfortunately. That's why I've never had much chance to, make some brass, if you will. I'd really like to, though. And, well, you may get your wish one of these days. Hopefully, I'll be able to make the opportunity to do a video about that, because it does matter. And as for that Gomer Powell-voiced Southern redneck Methodist liberal, it sounds like you're already on your way to becoming that anyway, from what you say. Remember, everyone listening, that liberalism, I'm talking about the real thing, not that fake stuff the Democrats are hawking called progressivism. Real liberalism means pretty much what Keith just said. Now here's a letter that I call constructive criticism. We got quite a bit of response on our episode about the Trayvon Martin George Zimmerman trial. This letter is from Jeff in Texas. He wrote a fairly long letter, so I can only present so much of it here due to time constraints, but I'll get you as much of the context as I can. Cowboy T, I have to comment on your last show on the Zimmerman Martin trial. It seems to me that you have discussed in previous episodes how liberals like to analyze facts and look at things. Meanwhile, you have completely ignored all the evidence and injected your own biases into the story. I have to question, do you actually believe in the liberal concept that you are innocent until proven guilty? And if so, how could you feel the prosecution proved their case beyond a reasonable doubt? We have two plausible scenarios here. It comes down to who initiated the fight, really. Either Zimmerman was walking and started a fight with Martin and was losing and then went to the gun, in which case he is a murderer, or Martin jumped Zimmerman, and Zimmerman, on the ground getting his head beat into the concrete, fearing for his life, used his gun in defense, in which case it was justified. So we already have a plausible, reasonable doubt scenario from the get-go. I'll give you a quick sum up of the rest of Jeff's letter. He then points out, correctly by the way, that Zimmerman did have as much right as Martin to be walking through that neighborhood. Same as my dad had a right to walk from his hotel room to his car when he was attacked. Jeff further mentioned several instances throughout Zimmerman's life showing, well, no reluctance to be with or be around or defend, even tutor the children of minorities, including black Americans, by the way. He then also mentions Martin and a history of both fights and drug use. He expresses the belief, originally told to us by Voltaire way back when, about better to let 10 guilty men go free than throw one innocent man in jail. I sure remember reading about that in school myself. He asked how I squared that belief with my personal beliefs about the Zimmerman case. Jeff, I hope I've expressed the gist of your letter reasonably accurately here. If not, please tell me. No, we don't agree on what probably happened in the Martin-Zimmerman case. And like I keep saying, this is America, and thank goodness we still get to do that here. Sure, my own life experiences and biases affected my view. Of course! What I submitted for your consideration is what I personally suspect happened. But we'll never know for sure what actually happened that night. All one who really does know is Mr. Zimmerman himself. I will say this, though. Doesn't matter what my personal views on the verdict are. The state of Florida needs to return Mr. Zimmerman's firearm back to him. The trial's over. He was acquitted. For better or worse, he was acquitted. And according to the law, the state officials have no business keeping his property like they are. Here's another letter regarding that same episode from Daniel in Pennsylvania. Cowboy T of Mr. Show, it's been too long since the last one. Wanted to say I disagree with your view on the Zimmerman case, specifically on who started the altercation that led to the untimely death of a young man. But I'm very glad you put it out. Gun folks tend to give the benefit of the doubt to the gun owner, listen to the facts, then make a decision based on those facts. I think antis tend to take the side of the non-gun owner, listen to the facts, and stay on the side of the non-gun owner based on emotion, disregarding the facts. When you gave an opposing view on the Zimmerman case than what everyone else on the Gun Rights Radio Network gave, proved my point. People of the gun make their own decisions and do not always blindly side with the gun owner. I'm sure more gun folks sided with Martin than antis sided with Zimmerman. Keep up the excellent work and put out the podcast more frequently. Daniel, thank you. I appreciate that. I wish I could do the podcast more often, believe me, because, oh boy, there's a lot to talk about. I've got so much going on in my life that every 2 weeks is about all I can really manage, really. Even then, it's not easy, as evidenced by when this is getting published. But it's still important, and that's why we're doing it. Okay, you and I may not agree about who probably started that altercation between Martin and Zimmerman. My mind can be changed by a cogent, rational argument based on facts. It has before. Unfortunately, too many people out here seem to prefer things like red herrings, invective, ad hominem attacks, the little quips and barbs that make for good sound bites, that kind of stuff. We hear it all the time. That's just the adult version of, you're a duty head from the playground days. To those folks who do that, come on. That's not going to convince me or anyone else who's interested in a rational argument. That's going to turn me away from you. You want to convince me? Okay, do it right and use logic. We'll read more of your letters here and there as you write them. Even if we don't agree, I appreciate the feedback. That's what I need to keep this show relevant for you all. Coming up, we're going to talk some more about rolling your own ammo. Stay tuned for Adventures in Reloading. Loading. Loading.
Loading. Loading. You can hear Gun Rights Radio Network on Stitcher Smart Radio. Stitcher allows you to listen to your favorite shows directly from your iPhone, Android phone, BlackBerry, or Palm phones. on demand and on the go. Don't have Stitcher? Download it for free today at Stitcher.com or in the app stores. Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Gun Rights Radio Network shows can be found under sources.
Let's talk a little about reloading. Been having some fun adventures with that recently. Just started reloading for 45 Auto, also known as 45 ACP. Yes, I know. Gotta tell you, folks, I was kind of wondering how much of a pain it'd be. Yeah, I know. Those of you who've seen my reloading videos, you know I do a lot of rimmed revolver cartridges. And this is why I was wondering, is this going to be a royal pain in the keister? Tell you why. Most of it's 38 Special, 357 Magnum, and 45 Colt. I shoot 38 Special the most. Reason? It's really economical, and, well, for that matter, it's fun. My Ruger-only 45 Colt Magnum load, though, that's my favorite. We'll talk more about that in a little bit. But here's the thing. This was really the first time I'd done any major runs of a semi-automatic cartridge like 45 Auto. I was, well, primarily concerned about head spacing. The reloading books say this matters a lot more for the semi-auto cartridges than for the rimmed revolver ones. My brass is all your standard range pickup hodgepodge of, you know, Federal, Winchester, PMC, and what else, a Spear, you name it, it's there. Oh, even some of those steel Wolf and Tula cases. That means there's the potential for slightly different case lengths. Seriously, folks, I had visions of sitting there with the case trimmer doing case after case after case. Sounded like it was, you know, like doing rifle rounds, the bottleneck ones. Not an appealing prospect. Well, I figured, what the hey. Let's try it first without case trimming and just see how it goes. Turns out, it wasn't even a concern. I had zero issues with case length. And that actually makes sense if you think through it for a minute. Here's the short version. I really like this load. It's a lot of fun. Now, the longer version. It's a near max load, according to the books, anyway. Tried it out in four different 1911s. Oh, and a Glock 21. Two of the 1911s were Kimbers, a Super Carry and a stainless 2. One was a Springfield, that was one of the 1911s, and the other 1911 was a GI-issue Colt Government from World War II, one of the 1917 revision models. The Glock was, well, it was a Glock. Well, regardless of the gun, this load is precise. Tiny little groups, you know, assuming the shooter, that would be me, does his part. And I've actually gotten pretty decent over the last few years at shooting. Helps when you're a range master, you get to go to the range a lot. The load uses a 200 grain lead round nose flat point that I cast myself. A lot of you know that I cast my own bullets too. In this case, it's Lee's 452-200-RF mold that I normally use for the light 45 Colt loads. Turns out to be great for 45 Auto as well. I was initially a little concerned about it feeding properly in, for example, older Colt 1911s because of the feed ramps. You see, the older guns were designed for straight-up round-nose ball ammo. Those feed ramps on the older guns, sometimes they don't like anything but that ball ammo shape. This bullet's not shaped like that. It's actually got a pretty wide maplat on it. Looks just like one of those Mesa rock formations, just like a tabletop. But turns out, no problems whatsoever. This 200 grain flat point wide maplat bullet fed just fine in everything I fed it through. So, now I know I've got a dual purpose mold. Pretty cool. Oh, by the way, I mentioned there were some steel Wolf and Tula cases in there too. Or technically, I guess it's called tool ammo. Anyways, there were about 20 or so of them. Normally, I just toss those in file 13 like we reloaders typically do. But I thought about it and said, what the hey? Why not? Let's give them a try. See what happens. Not sure why, but, well, the Russian ammo factories have changed up on their priming. They've gone from Bird-Am priming to Boxer priming for, well, at least certain cartridges that they send over here to the States. 45 Auto's like that. It's one of those. So, into the press they went. Turns out those steel cases work just fine. So far, they're on their third firing. They're showing no signs of splitting, no stretched out primer pockets, nor any other problems. since they're boxer-primed. Yeah, I know, steel cases with boxer primers. They reload just like any cases from anybody else. Oh, I do use the Tula primers as well, by the way. This bit about how you'll damage your dies if you reload steel cases, if you run the steel cases through your resizing die? Huh, please. That's hogwash. Virtually all modern dies have that tungsten carbide ring or something similar to that. That's not going to have any problem with that mild steel that they use for making those cases. No, it won't hurt your gun either. You know, not if your gun is of any decent quality, and just about all of them are. Oh, but those steel cases won't last as long as the brass ones. So what? They were free. Range pickup, folks. Didn't cost me nothing. Even if I get one extra load out of them, that's one more load I didn't have to go buy. It's one more load that I had. Yeah, I'll take that. And like I said, I've gotten more than one. Now I figured, okay, the 1911s love this load. So let's give the Glock 21 a shot with them. We've got a Glock 21 rental gun at the shop. Gotta tell you, this new load shoots just as precisely in the Glock as it does in the 1911s, and that's pretty good. But every third or fourth round, I get a light primer strike. This is in the Glock. You could tell from the dimple in the primer cup. Second shot always went bang, so I know it was a light primer strike. On those rounds that didn't go bang the first time, the dimple in the primer cup was pretty well off center. Not sure what's going on there. I don't know, maybe the gun needs a little tune-up. Probably just needs a good cleaning, really. It is our rental gun, after all, and let me tell you, being out there watching the range, I know for a fact it sees a lot of use. But every round that did fire hit right where I pointed the sights. One more thing. You know that bit about don't shoot cast bullets through Glocks? I did tell you I'm using cast bullets in this load. You see this on the internet all the time, folks. You know, because of the polygonal rifling, don't shoot cast through Glocks. Yep, that's hogwash too. Cast bullets work just great in Glocks. Seriously, they don't foul up the barrel, not as long as you have them, your bullets properly sized and properly lubed, just like you're supposed to for any other gun. Lube them right, and size them properly, and stick with a softer lead like wheel weights or even softer, you'll be just fine. I'll give you another reason to reload 45 auto. Try heading to your local ammo store. You see any? Yeah, thought so. At the present moment, we are still smack in the middle of the great ammo shortage of 2013. If there's any ammo, it's the Hornady Critical Defense, the Speer Gold Dot, the Federal HydroShock, all those. Y'all know that's French for EXPENSIVE, right? Expensive. I got no problem with the Rockefellers, folks. But most of us aren't them, okay? So we've got to go with the inexpensive range practice ammo. Nowadays, you find that most often at your local Walmart. But, of course, as we all know, those covers have been pretty bare ever since the tragedy at Sandy Hook. They ain't got nothing. So, what to do? Well, that's easy. Just roll your own like I do. I save a truckload of money. Oh, and I have no ammo availability problems. I always have ammo anytime I want it. If you want to learn how to do this, check out the videos at www.sanfranciscoliberalwithagun.com or the YouTube channel Cowboy T. Used to be called SF Liberal. That's Google for you. Now, why am I telling you all this? Well, folks, I'm telling you all about all this because, well, knowledge is power. Yeah, knowledge is power. You need to know this. I learned that not only from my school teachers and college professors, knowledge is power, but also from my time working in the school district. Educators in particular are supposed to know that and preach that. But they don't always. We've already talked about what some educators are doing, even to little kids as young as 5 years old. You know, you remember the assault Pop-Tart? Well, that mindset seems to continue in a whole lot of our institutions of higher learning. When we come back, we're going to briefly discuss colleges, the antis, the right to carry, and what we need to be doing about it. Stay tuned.
This podcast is supported from donations from listeners like you. Thank you for your support. We welcome one-time donations or $2 a month subscription to help support this podcast and Gun Rights Radio Network in its effort to bring you the high-quality pro-Second Amendment podcasts. Every dollar you donate goes directly back into the network. So visit gunrightsradio.com and click on the donation button. We accept all types of credit cards, and PayPal accounts are not required. Gunrightsradio.com.
We are back. Let's talk colleges and universities. Yes, those learned institutions of higher learning. Most of them, turns out, have a pretty strict anti-gun policy. It usually says something along the lines of, you bring a gun onto campus, you're going to have problems. If you're a student, we'll expel you from the university. If you're a staff member, you're fired.
Fire, 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 fire.
Yep, this policy was in place when the Virginia Tech massacre happened in 2007. Uh-huh. I guess that policy wasn't so effective after all, was it? Didn't stop that gunman from bringing two handguns and shooting up classrooms, did it? Well, the antis, of course, love policies like this that disarm the good folks, even though they know that it doesn't stop the bad folks, like that Virginia Tech murderer. They've got allies in the administrations of these institutions of higher learning. Well, in Virginia, officially the rule is that each such institution can set its own policies regarding firearms on campus. Unfortunately, since all but one of these institutions are run by the antis, effectively, no, you cannot carry on campus if you're a student or a staff member. Those who aren't students or staff members, state law governs them, but that's only because the university doesn't have control of your degree or your paycheck. If they do, they'll sanction you that way. The only exception that I know of is Liberty University. And, well, that's a private institution anyway, not a state school. The only state school I know of was a community college out in the middle of the country in Virginia, and under political pressure, they reversed their decision, sadly. State schools, like, say, the University of Virginia, James Madison University, Virginia Tech, George Mason University, and all the state community colleges, they have this little thing called resident tuition. Uh-huh. Any of you who've gone to college, you know what that means. It means considerably more affordable tuition if you're a legal resident of that state. It's usually half, in many cases even a third of what everyone else pays. That's because state schools, being subsidized by the state, were intended to focus on state residents. Well, that's the whole point. Duh. Even better, turns out Virginia has some mighty fine state schools. Therefore, naturally, most state residents who don't have megabucks, they want to go to these excellent institutions. Now, in Virginia, we have this thing called preemption, which says local municipalities cannot impose any rules about guns that are more restrictive than the state legislature, or as we call it here, the General Assembly, has allowed. That means the anti-gun folks in, say, one example, the city of Alexandria, they cannot impose things like waiting periods or registration requirements or any of that other stuff. They desperately want to, rest assured, but they can't, because state law says they can't. Fairfax County, which is right next to the city of Alexandria, tried to impose a 3-day waiting period some years back, and they got sued for it. They backed off, but quick. However, state agencies are not local municipalities under the law. Thus, they are not included in the preemption law, since state colleges and universities are indeed state agencies. They're exempt from the preemption law. I call this the state agency loophole. We need to close this dangerous loophole. And as Virginia Tech showed, it is a dangerous loophole. 32 innocent lives got snuffed out because of the state agency loophole. But we know what the antis are going to say. They're going to go on about how
skulls are sensitive places.
They're, of course, quoting Justice Scalia's majority opinion in the D.C. versus Heller case when he talked about so-called sensitive places. Well, I know for a fact that I can walk in right in the middle of City Hall or the county government center while carrying a gun. Totally legally. I've actually open carried into City Hall before as an exercise of my rights. By the way, we need to do that every so often just to remind people that, yes, this is a right, not a privilege. Met my legislators and spoke with them. Obviously, they knew I was carrying. It's kind of hard to miss a big old hunting revolver like that. But they didn't seem to have any problem with it. Totally calm. There were all sorts of other people in that room, too, and probably over 200 folks. There was no carnage. There was no murder. Just a good discussion of things that matter to us, the people of that district, and if and how our elected officials are going to support that. Standard town hall meeting type stuff, folks. Now, if that can happen right in the middle of City Hall, how is a college or university any more sensitive than the City Hall where carrying is fully allowed? Oh, same applies at the county government center, too. The only county building where you can't carry is the courthouse. Everywhere else, no problem, including the police station. Heck, get this. We can even do it in the State General Assembly building. Yes, the state legislature itself. I know this because we do it every year on Lobby Day. But for some reason, the antis have deemed state colleges and universities even more sensitive than the State General Assembly building, City Hall, the police precinct, and other county or city buildings. Gotta tell you, I don't see the logic in gun bans in colleges and universities when we don't do it in these other places. And it seems I'm not the only one who sees this, in my view, rather questionable exemption for state agencies. For that reason, the Virginia Citizens Defense League, the VCDL, is working on legislation to get preemption extended to not just local municipalities like it is today, but also to state agencies. This would close the state agency loophole and at least give the students on these state campuses a fighting chance, a greater than zero chance, against another lunatic killer like the one at Virginia Tech in 2007. You know how the antis want to impose their anti-gun agenda by force of law onto us, saying, "We know what's good for you, we'll decide for you from on up high." Well, they sure did change their tune when we started talking about preemption applying to state agencies. Yes, sirree. Now it's, "Oh no, you have no business trying to take the decision-making power out of the local college administrators. They know what's best for their local environments." Oh, really? So let's see here. They're for strong central control when it's for their agenda, but they switch in favor of local control when it's not for their agenda. Interesting. It's just like that states' rights argument that the antis made when the Thune Amendment was being debated in the Senate a few years back. You all remember that? This is the amendment that, had it become law, would have mandated nationwide reciprocity for concealed carry permits between all 50 states. The antis, like Dianne Feinstein is one example, all of a sudden started yelling about something I hadn't heard about since the days before the Civil War. States' rights. Uh-huh. Oh, and local control, when otherwise these antis are for federal preemption and central control with other things, you see. You see, the antis know good and well that these colleges and universities are run by, you guessed it, fellow antis. That's what I think is called opportunistic ethics. Even if that's not the official term, I think you all can pretty much understand what I'm getting at. See, if the colleges and universities were run by pro-Second Amendment administrators, the antis surely would be marching in the streets demanding central control! Central control! Take that decision power away from the local administrators and reserve it for the state! That's not anywhere even remotely close to the liberal way of doing things. It might be what the progressives like, but it sure ain't liberal. Here's what a liberal would say. Excuse me, there are these two things called the Virginia Constitution and the United States Constitution. Both of them guarantee, in writing, the right to keep and bear arms, and that said right shall not be infringed. This is why I fully back extending preemption to state agencies. I might be able to understand barring firearms by civilians in a state court. Criminal trials happen there. But I see no good reason to bar them in colleges and universities any more than they're barred right now at City Hall. So what can you do? Well, for those of you in states that have preemption laws, like Virginia does, get active in supporting extending preemption to your state colleges and universities. That's the only way that will actually be effective in stopping murderers who want to shoot up college classrooms. Oh, you don't believe me? Okay, how about a cop then? You want to deter another Virginia Tech murder? Well, what you have to do is hit him with a deep existential question. Something that will make him re-examine and re-evaluate his own personal values and lifestyle. His own hopes and dreams, as related to the moment at hand. It can even be phrased without words. A question like, you don't want me to have to shoot you in the face with this .38 special, do you, scumbag? Those words are those of Captain, Police Captain, Mossad Ayoub from his book In the Gravest Extreme. And, as my dad has demonstrated, Mr. Ayoub is correct. It's like I've been saying for years, folks. Just one armed good guy might have been able to stop that killer at Virginia Tech before he took out 32 innocent lives. Would it have been a guarantee to stop that killer? No, of course not. But at least they would have stood a greater than zero chance, some kind of fighting chance, at stopping him, though. Because, as it was, they had no chance. All they had were their own bodies. Virginia Tech's anti-gun policy made sure of that, and 32 lives were snuffed out as a result. Now, folks, victim disarmament is not a good policy. Remember, VD can kill. I'll give you a little teaser about the next episode. We're going to go into this a bit more then, too. Give an example of this mindset in action. Take a short station ID break. Be right back.
The forums are a great place to interact with the podcasters and listeners to your favorite podcast. Visit gunrightsradio.com and click on the forums button at the top of the page and sign up for your free membership, gunrightsradio.com.
Okay, folks, we're continuing our bit of testimony from people who've lived in places where the people's natural right of self-defense is not respected. And that includes the right to keep and bear arms. This time, we're going to listen to Dr. Sofal Ir, a Cambodian-American immigrant who escaped the Khmer Rouge in the 1970s. For those of you who don't know what the Khmer Rouge is, you can consider it the Cambodian version of Kim Il-sung's Communist Party. It was run by a fellow named Pol Pot. Ah, perhaps you've heard of that guy. Yeah, him. Well, in their so-called liberation of Cambodia, this Khmer Rouge, led by this Pol Pot, killed 1.5 million of their own people. This is, by the way, out of a total population of 7 million. Over 20% of the population exterminated. Professor Ir was born in Phnom Penh in December of 74. What you're about to hear is a remarkable story of a mother who would do anything and everything to save her children from armed government thugs. Professor Ir is her son. He's now 38 years old and teaches national security affairs at the U.S. Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California. Perhaps fittingly, Professor Ir's research is on post-conflict reconstruction, stability, transition, democratization, and several other related items too, with a special focus on Cambodia, where he was born. You don't have to believe me when I say it could happen here. But please, lend an ear to Professor Ear.
I normally teach courses on how to rebuild states after war, but today I've got a personal story to share with you. This is a picture of my family, my four siblings, my mom and I, taken in 1977, and we're actually Cambodians, and this picture is taken in Vietnam. So how did a Cambodian family end up in Vietnam in 1977? Well, to explain that, I've got a short video clip to explain the Khmer Rouge regime during 1975 and 1979.
April 17th, 1975. The communist Khmer Rouge enters Phnom Penh to liberate their people from the encroaching conflict in Vietnam and American bombing campaigns. Led by peasant-born Pol Pot, the Khmer Rouge evacuates people to the countryside in order to create a rural communist utopia, much like Mao Zedong's Cultural Revolution in China. The Khmer Rouge closes the doors to the outside world, but after 4 years, the grim truth seeps out. In a country of only 7 million people, 1.5 million were murdered by their own leaders, their bodies piled in the mass graves of the killing fields.
So notwithstanding the 1970s narration, on April 17, 1975, we lived in Phnom Penh. And my parents were told by the Khmer Rouge to evacuate the city because of impending American bombing for 3 days. And here's a picture of the Khmer Rouge. They were actually young soldiers, typically child soldiers. And this is very normal now of modern-day conflict because they're easy to bring into wars. The reason that they gave about American bombing wasn't all that far off. I mean, from 1965 to 1973, there were more munitions that fell on Cambodia than in all of World War II Japan, including the two nuclear bombs of August 1945. The Khmer Rouge didn't believe in money, so the equivalent of the Federal Reserve Bank in Cambodia was bombed, but not just that, they actually banned money. I think it's the only precedent in which money has ever been stopped from being used, and we know money is the root of all evil, but it didn't actually stop evil from happening in Cambodia, in fact. My family was moved from Phnom Penh to Pursat province. This is a picture of what Pursat looks like. It's actually a very pretty area of Cambodia where rice growing takes place. And in fact, they were forced to work the field. So my father and mother ended up in a sort of concentration camp, labor camp. And it was at that time that my mother got word from the commune chief that the Vietnamese were actually asking for their citizens to go back to Vietnam. And she spoke some Vietnamese as a child, having grown up with Vietnamese friends. And she decided, despite the advice of her neighbors, that she would take the chance and claim to be Vietnamese so that we could have a chance to survive. Because at this point, they're forcing everybody to work and they're giving about, in the modern-day caloric restriction diet, I guess, they're giving it porridge with a few grains of rice. And at about this time, actually, my father got very sick, and he didn't speak Vietnamese, so he died, actually, in January 1976, and it made it possible, in fact, for us to take on this plan. So the Khmer Rouge took us from a place called Pursat to Koh Tiu, which is across from the border from Vietnam, and there they had a detention camp where alleged Vietnamese would be tested, language tested. And my mother's Vietnamese was so bad that to make our story more credible, she'd given all the boys and girls new Vietnamese names, but she'd given the boys girls' names and the girls boys' names. And it wasn't until she met a Vietnamese lady who told her this and then tutored her for 2 days intensively that she was able to go into her exam. And, you know, this is a moment of truth. If she fails, we're all headed to the gallows. If she passes, we can leave to Vietnam. And she actually, of course, I'm here, she passes. And we end up in Hung Nu on the Vietnamese side and then onwards to Chau Duc. And this is a picture of Hung Nu, Vietnam today, a pretty idyllic place on the Mekong Delta. But for us, it meant freedom, freedom from persecution from the Khmer Rouge. Last year, the Khmer Rouge Tribunal, which the UN is helping Cambodia take on, started, and I decided that as a matter of record, I should file a civil complaint with the tribunal about my father's passing away. And I got word last month that the complaint was officially accepted by the Khmer Rouge Tribunal. And it's for me a matter of justice for history and accountability for the future, because Cambodia remains a pretty lawless place at times. 5 years ago, my mother and I went back to Chao Duc, and she was able to return to a place that for her meant freedom, but also fear, because she had just come. We'd just come out of Cambodia, and I'm happy actually today to present her. She's here today with us in the audience. And thank you, Mother.
Well, there it is, folks. You just heard it. This is what happens when the government officials have guns and you don't. Religious folks would probably say it was by the grace of God or something similar that this family made it out of there alive. As you heard, his father didn't make it. He died of malnutrition in January of 76. That family took a heck of a chance. If his mother failed, it was the gallows. Literally, do or die. By some miracle, they made it here safely. But how about all the other folks in places like Cambodia and Vietnam who want liberty, even today? I used to work with a fella, a Vietnamese guy, now he's an American citizen, who told me, you go back to the Nam, the cops can beat you up anytime they want. You can't do anything about it. This is what happens when the government officials have guns and you don't. I know some of you might find that kind of hard to swallow. This is America, right? Can't happen here. Well, you don't have to believe me. But you might want to believe the man you just heard. We like to give credit where it's due here on the Liberals Gun Corner. I'd like to thank the TED Talks for what you just heard. Stands for Technology, Entertainment, and Design, TED, TED. But obviously they do more than just those things now, those three things now. They refer to their TED Talks as ideas worth spreading. Since you just heard one, hopefully you agree. And now I got another question for you. And it's a very serious one. It's this. What country can preserve its liberties if their rulers are not warned from time to time that their people preserve the spirit of resistance? Here's one answer. Let them take arms. The remedy is to set them right as to the facts, pardon and pacify them. What signify a few lives lost in a century or two? The tree of liberty must be refreshed from time to time with the blood of patriots and tyrants. It is its natural manure. Sound radical? I hope not. That's Thomas Jefferson talking. Yep, the founding father. He proposed an answer that made sense to him. Hopefully you've got an answer to that question, at least for yourself. Somehow I get the feeling that the people of Cambodia would agree with what he said there. Especially after somehow living through Pol Pot and the Khmer Rouge. Folks, that's why the most liberal thing we can do is defend the right to keep and bear arms. It is only by the Second Amendment that the other nine remain in force. And by the way, oh yeah, that goes for ammunition too, so we've got to defend that just as strongly. Episode 20, the last one, should have scared the hell out of you. It was meant to. And if it didn't, well, you really ought to listen to it again. Folks, I wish this weren't true, but it is. Our own liberty depends on it. So we've got to defend it. This is Cowboy T, signing off until next time. Till then, safe shooting, practice often, and thanks for listening.